The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
Our next guest is an acclaimed football historian, and he has written The Age of Football, The Global Game in the 21st Century. David Goldblatt, thank you very much for being with us here on The Last Word of Today FM. One of the things that you touch upon, or the many things you touch upon in this book that I'm fascinated by, is how the economics of soccer has continued to expand at a time of a global crash a decade ago. How did football pull off the trick of continuing almost without any kickback?
Well, it's a bit like the banking or the finance industry, which, despite causing the global crash, has prospered mightily over the last 10 years and is, you know, back profitable, back paying enormous salaries and bonuses. And I think it's about the global character of the industry in the first place. The second is that what is really driving the expansion of football financially is an ever-increasing global audience. And while it's certainly the case that, you know, there has been recession in some countries, the number of people able to access the internet and able to access television is increasing every single week all over the planet. And that's what's delivering the value of television rights, the value of sponsorships, which is where football makes most of its money, and the appetite is absolutely insatiable.
Yeah, but there was a time when football used to make its money from attendances in the ground. But the television, how much of us just benefited from the whole changing nature of television, the competition between stations to get rights to show? Because the only thing that television can get audience, it seems, out of these days is live sports events.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, match attendance now for the big clubs in England, for example, would be at most around 25-30%. But a lot of that is the kind of banquets and buffets end, where you're paying at Tottenham Hotspur's £2,500, you know, for your box seat and your seven course meal. So if you actually take that out of it, it's probably actually tickets is as little as 10%
of the overall revenue
at the biggest clubs, which is why it was said during the last round of TV rights for the EPL that the clubs could afford to make every ticket free in the stadium and still be making more money than they were beforehand.
Yeah, but not the redeveloped stadia such as Tottenham's or even Arsenal's. Presumably there's so much money has gone into the construction of those that they do require to be full nearly all the time to actually pay back the construction costs.
Not really. I mean, you know, because most of their costs are players' wages. I mean, you know, it's around 70%, even for the biggest clubs, is being spent on wages. That's really where the vast majority of the money goes. And yes, there is a certain amount of payback, you know, as with any normal business, if you invest in increasing capacity. But, you know, the money involved is so huge, and it's not just the domestic TV rights, which once upon a time would have been the lion's share of the income of any football league. Now the English Premier League is earning more money from its overseas rights sales. So, you know, China, for example, which, let's say, 20 years ago when the Premiership began, wasn't taking any kind of English football, let alone paying big money for it. Now it's one of the most expensive sets of TV rights. I mean, China is paying more for EPL rights to show in China than NBC is paying to show it in the United States.
How long will that last for, though, if you have a situation where English football becomes more predictable in the sense that Liverpool and Manchester City have a dominance of the kind that Real Madrid and Barcelona have had in Spain? If also, perhaps, if players are less willing to go to Britain in the event of Brexit?
I mean, what I would say is, you know, Manchester United's complete hegemony over the English Premier League didn't slow down the pace of increasing value of television rights. Though I think you're right to say, in the very long term, a complete absence of competition is a problem. However, it doesn't seem to me that, you know, a duopoly at the top will stop people watching the league. I mean, it was interesting, when I was in Nigeria, I spent a week watching more Premier League television than I would ever watch at home in England. And I was hanging out with the official supporters clubs of Manchester United, Tottenham, Arsenal, Lagos branch. And I said to one guy, you know, what is it? What is it, you know, that you love about the Premier League? And he said, well, you know, I watch El Clasico, but if it's Getafe Malaga, I'm not interested. But you know what? Stoke versus West Brom, I'm there. And people consume the Premier League in ways that are, I think, unusual for conventional European thinking about football. It's not just about the one club, it's about the whole. And they're happy to watch the kind of competition that's going on at the bottom to avoid relegation as much as they are at the top.
Of course, funnily enough, you've mentioned two teams that have fallen out of the Premier League, which are now in the Championship. And when a club falls out, the financial consequences are phenomenal, because you actually see teams tumbling down a further division. They just can't cope with the difference in revenue streams and costs between the top two divisions.
I mean, this is bad planning, bad contracts, not good enough lawyers is part of the problem, because some teams do handle it. I think then there is also a desperation when you go down into the Championship. You get even more over-optimistic, overspending amongst many of those clubs. I mean, Sunderland and Charlton would be good examples of where you actually go down two levels. But to return to your original point about how long it can last, I wonder whether the thing that might dent it is not that there is the dominance of two or three teams, but what is the crowd like? Because I think what makes the Premier League so popular in so many places is a combination of two things. One, a phenomenal concentration of international and global talent. And secondly, the enduring cultural capital and significance of the English crowd.
The atmosphere, you know, that's created
exactly
in the ground is also something that's attractive to a TV
they
audience.
They love it. I mean, watch Serie A. Half the time it's to empty stadiums, you know, whole empty stands, silence for much of it. Whereas, you know, pretty much every Premier League game is packed, and the English crowd still is capable of wit, of energy, of emotional dynamism. What might kill that, though, seems to me an issue about age. If you go back to 1992, when the Premiership first began, we can estimate roughly that the average age of the audience is about 25, and 25% of the audience is unaccompanied youth, sort of, you know, 21 and under down to 16. That makes a huge difference when you've got that kind of energy. I'm a 53-year-old man. I love 53-year-old men, but if the stadium is full of me, it's a problem.
And the average age of the audience aren't coming along with the adults as well.
Well, that no longer happens, because who can afford to take their kids? And the average age of the audience in the Premier League is now around 48, 49, heading for 50. That, in the long term, seems to me more of a problem. And increasingly, it does seem to be amongst, you know, the younger generation, amongst millennials, there is an appetite for the highlights reel, for the 3 or 4 minutes that works on your phone on social media. But the 90-minute experience is much more problematic, I think, for many of them. I also notice, you know, increasingly the number of tourist fans. And again, I don't have a
lot
problem.
From Ireland.
Well, an awful lot, 120,000 a year minimum making the crossing from the Republic to England to watch Premier League games. I mean, that's filling, you know, Villa Park kind of four times over. That's a really significant thing.
Indeed, it's in your book, David Goldblatt, The Age of Football, The Global Game of the 21st Century. You look at the impact on Irish football, on the League of Ireland, and you make reference to the 1950s and 60s when we used to have big crowds at the games here in Ireland, and it's now collapsed. You don't seem particularly encouraging at the possibility that we'll ever be able to build that back up again while we remain in the shadow of this global game alongside us.
And also under the auspices of the FAI, whose commitment to youth development and generally organising Irish football is, to say the least, poor. And let's face it, there's a lot of competition in the poor department amongst football associations. And it's not just Ireland. Take a look at Africa, where, you know, 400 million people every single week are watching the EPL. And Africa, like Ireland, if you go back to the 50s, the 60s and the 70s, you have a vibrant local domestic scene. You have big crowds, you have derbies that mean something, you have away fans. In the case of Africa, the most extraordinary traditions of locally generated commentary, because it's such a fabulous oral storytelling culture, amazing music, people sleeping overnight inside stadiums to ensure that they've got a seat the next day. And now the biggest game in Ghana, Asante Kotoko versus Hearts of Oak, they're barely filling half the stadium and less. The television money is completely hopeless. And this is a real problem. You know, in other places, I mean, even Latin America, where people are still watching their own football, the spectacle is a shadow of itself, because, you know, you look, go and watch. I went and saw Racing versus Independiente, and it's like, Everybody's very young, very old, or going nowhere. And their players have just completely disappeared.
David Goldblatt, the last thing I want to examine with you in the time we've available is the draw of international football as against club games. Because we here in Ireland, we'd have had the magnificent times and Jack Charlton, European Championships, the first ones we got to in 1988, World Cups in 90 and 94, again in 2002. And the great joy that there was and the national sense of achievement by having those teams at the games and stuff. But now, when Ireland play a home international, we don't get full houses anymore. I don't think we have probably since back in the qualification for the 2016 European Championships. A feeling that the players are coming from substandard teams because they're not all of them in the Premier League, or if they are, they're reserves. What way is international football going? Is this a sort of a general international phenomenon, less interest, or will the pull of supporting your national team overcome the finances of putting all the best players and the best teams in the Champions League?
It's a very good question. I mean, I think the fate of international football is going in different directions in different places. I mean, you know, in the case of Iceland, for example, you know, you couldn't get fuller houses.
What a story.
I mean, I went and saw Iceland versus Hungary in Marseille, and approximately 10% of the entire Icelandic population was there in the stadium. You know, so the sort of level of devotion to international football can actually be extraordinary. I mean, I do think if you're sated, let's say, on the English Premier League week in, week out, then, you know, watching the Republic play Montenegro or whatever, you know, is going to be less exciting. Though, if Ireland, and I expect they will do, qualify for Euro 2020, I imagine there will be the most gigantic following crowds.
But particularly with some of the games coming here as well.
I think that's, yeah, which is great. I'm so pleased that there are a few games coming to Dublin. I mean, I think, you know, what the big international tournaments rather than the qualification rounds offer is that kind of, you know, amazing, otherworldly, you know, more than a holiday, that kind of foreign adventure, the immersion in other cultures, the opportunity to meet all sorts of other folk as well as have a beer or two. And I don't think at the moment that the Premier League or club football quite delivers that in quite the same way.
But
I think there's still a place for it.
Yeah, but David, could it be, just to finish, and without getting too nostalgic because we're at the same age, but I think maybe for our generation, we grew up on things like the 1978 and 82 World Cups, the 74 World Cup. And it was almost the fact that we rarely got to see these great players in great games. We only maybe read about them or heard the matches on the radio. There was something special. I wonder, does the younger generation that we were talking about not going to games, is it because there's too much available to them that there's less something special about football?
I think that's a very interesting point. And certainly in the past, there was a real kind of mystery about the World Cup. It's like, you know, Colombians, what do they look like? How do they play? Whoever sees a Colombian play.
You get to see Johan Cruyff and Johan Niskanen, players that
for
you
sure.
Rarely got to see on television, from the European Cup final.
On the other hand, it remains the case that there is nothing for me as special in this world as going to a big game of football. You know, we live in a world, not just here in the British Isles, but more widely, in which, you know, everything is about me, 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 atomized, individualistic. And football is about we. And there are few better ways of experiencing the we-ness of the world than seeing international football for your country.
That said, your book is great on what divides us in football rather than uniting us, but I'm out of time. The book is called The Age of Football, The Global Game in the 21st Century. David Goldblatt, it's been great having you here on The Last Word of Today FM.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.